We're in Beverly Hills, California, at the office of Art Linkletter, who is a man who put together a radio program in the golden age of radio that was mostly a visual show, and how he translated the visual of People Are Funny to the radio tube is something we want to find out. Art Linkletter, how did you do that?
Well, of course, we didn't know anything about television when we started it, so we didn't have any problems. We just described everything that went on and prayed for the day when television would arrive. And, of course, when television did arrive, we found out that it had many, many limitations and that a lot of the fun of People Are Funny was gone because anticipation is greater than realization. And things that you could describe as being funny often weren't really that funny. So it was a very interesting experience to have spent 10 years in radio waiting for television and then to find out that it had many, many limitations on it. As a matter of fact, as Jack Benny, as I used to say, radio is a participatory experience and television is a passive spectator sport where everything is laid out for you and you have no room for imagination. No room for heightened enjoyment of things depending on your own cultural and educational background. It's all laid out flat. And whereas in the old days when People Are Funny, to use an extreme example, we would hit somebody in the face with a chocolate meringue pie, if you were listening to it, you could visualize that as aesthetically as you wished it to be or as crudely and burlesque as you wished it to be. When it was on television, there was no possible point of interpretation. There it was, and it made some people angry and made some people happy.
Where did People Are Funny come from in the first place? How did it all begin?
I was doing a number of radio shows in San Francisco. I was the radio, Mr. Radio of San Francisco, doing 21 shows a week on 7 stations, Man in the Street, Who's Dancing Tonight from the Ballroom, and Are You a Genius from Oakland, and many other programs. And it occurred to me that a program built on psychology would be most interesting, since I was a psychology major in minor in college, an English major. So I devised a program idea called Meet Yourself, in which I would get people up to the microphone, have them answer questions or participate in a stunt, and then have a famous psychologist from Stanford University come into the picture and interpret that person's personality. Is he an ambivert or an introvert or extrovert or whatever he was, depending upon what the stunt was? And then we would go on to the next stunt. I came to Hollywood one time on a chore that was not related to this, and I ran into a man named John Goodell, and he had exactly the same idea. Only he had a psychologist from USC, and he called it People Are Funny, while mine was Meet Yourself. Look into the mirror of your own self and find out really who you are. So John and I found that we were compatible. We were both writers. We were both idea men. He was a producer and I was a performer. So we pooled our talents, took his title, which was the better, more saleable title. We spent $15 each, which was a total of $30, borrowed a studio at NBC, assembled a cast of characters, and made a pilot. Well, the psychologist didn't work out because we wanted him to be strong and definitive. We wanted to do a stunt, and then he would give a complete analysis of that person. And naturally, a professional psychologist from a big university would only say, there is an indication that possibly, under certain circumstances, this man might conceivably be this way. We wanted him to say he is thus and so. Uh-huh. So we threw him out and left the stunts in. We sent the record to a Chicago agency named Russell Seeds, who was having problems with the United States government over a program called Sergeant Quirt and Captain Flag, because World War II was beginning, and it was a very... the show that they had on for a tobacco company was a very tough show between a non-com and a private, mm-hmm. and a captain, that is, a commissioned officer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they were canceling that show, and just at that moment they needed something else. And they picked up People Are Funny, and we were off and running. So here was the birth of a show which ran for 19 years.
It ran on radio from about 42 until when?
Until about 53.
53.
And then it went into television until about 61 or 2.
Was it on television at the same time it was on radio at any point?
Yes, at one time, just as a house party. Which I did on CBS, and I went. I was on both networks.
That's a little unusual, isn't it?
Very, especially during those years when there was so much competition between the two. But I was on 5 days a week on CBS, on radio, and then finally TV. And both shows were suited for radio or TV, and they at one time were on all four networks, the radio and the television. On each two networks, so it was quite an adventure.
Was there any problem with doing that?
No, I just had to be sure that that I was loyal and capable and did a good show of each, and in fact, it was better for me because each network was trying to make its show more important to me and to the viewer than the other network's show, and so I got reams of publicity and attention. And all the things that make young, rising MCs happy.
Was it, you said before, it was actually easier to do People Are Funny on radio than on television. How did you find that transitional period, though?
Well, as a matter of fact, what I did, to tell you the secret inside truth, was that I was so concerned about the worries of television and the transition that I went over to ABC and saw the Jolly Green Giant, a show called Life with Linkletter. Which was really a hidden version of People Are Funny under a different title. And so there I was on all three networks. The real People Are Funny on NBC radio. The substitute People Are Funny under a different title on television on ABC. And the house party on radio. And there it was that we first found on the Life with Linkletter show, which ran for a year and a half before NBC decided that People Are Funny had the priority and wanted it on the air on television. We found, for instance, that if we gave a lady a skunk and sent her up Hollywood Boulevard on a mission, that the description of the expressions on the faces of the passersby evoked a much better image in the listener's eye than the occasional blasé and even indifference with which on Hollywood Boulevard you would greet a lady with a skunk on a leash.
Was People Are Funny live on television or was it on film?
It was live at first and then it was filmed.
Was it better on film or live?
Yes, it was better on film because we could edit. And some great, great stunts didn't pay off the way they should have because people didn't react the way they should have. I'm amused at today's game shows, which I see on TV, in which when a person wins money, he jumps up and down and squeals and yells and kisses the MC and falls down and does all that stuff. That's not natural. That's not the way people react. That's all coached. That's not only coached, but it's threatened. If they don't react that way, they're never seen. Whereas we never told people how to react. You see, there were the old quiz scandals of a number of years ago where the producers of these kinds of game shows that gave contestants answers were knocked out of the box. But today we have not getting the answers, but getting coached even more so as to reactions.
To react, yeah. What, did you ever have any problems with reactions, people's reactions to a
Our only problem was they didn't react strongly enough.
They didn't.
We'd give somebody a house or a car, and they'd say, thanks. We would put together two brothers who hadn't seen each other for 35 years and had been separated by family problems. We brought them together and say, hi, Joe, instead of crying. On the other hand, there were times when we got gigantic response out of very little things. You just don't know. People are funny. They're unpredictable. And if you look at the shows across the board today in the daytime, you will see that they are predictable and they are the same and they are reacting exactly like two peas in a pod, whatever show you see.
You were doing an audience participation show probably before anybody else was doing it.
Ralph Edwards and myself,
Ralph
and John Goodell. We three, my partner John, myself, and Ralph, he had Truth or Consequences, and the two shows started at approximately the same time. And we were fighting all the time about who got the ideas and who didn't. And now, of course, we're good friends, but there was a lot of tension in the early days when we were both trying to make it. But we originated between the two of us, or the three of us, that is, about a third of all the shows you see today, like To Tell the Truth, The Price is Right, and Let's Make a Deal. We were hiding shows, prizes in boxes and behind screens. And
well, I know that you particularly, perhaps on the house party more than on People Are Funny, would tantalize someone in the audience. You'd ask a lady to open her purse or something like that. There were elements of People Are Funny in the house party.
All the way through, yes. I never did care for quiz shows. Mm-hmm. Never wanted to do a quiz show, although I've done some. But I always wanted to have audience reactions to people undergoing real life hazards and suspense and problems. And we did the things. Well, we did a show that there's a show called Hot Seat now. We've done that. We've done everything with lie detectors, with we just did everything. But interestingly enough, none of us at the time thought that you could take one idea that we would do, because it might be exceptionally interesting, we would repeat it in various forms about once every 5 or 6 weeks for 6 minutes. And we never dreamed that somebody could take that idea and do it for 30 minutes 5 days a week and nothing else. And that's what they did.
They copied a little Linkletter idea.
A little tiny wee thing we wouldn't think of repeating.
Were there any of your stunts that you had that really backfired from how you had expected it to
Oh, build? Yes. We had people, for instance, who got mad on stage. We got two neighbors together one time. Neither one of them knew they were going to be on the program. And we had researched and discovered that they had a problem in the neighborhood, and they feuded. And we thought if we got them on the air in front of a live coast-to-coast audience and confronted them with the childishness of a simple argument over a dog, that the neighborhood, which was really split 50-50, would get back together again. And we'd give them a wonderful prize of a trip to Europe together. Well, they would have nothing of this. When they found that the other one was on the stage, fireworks ensued, and they wouldn't talk to each other, and they wouldn't accept a prize, and they made it even worse than it was before, because now it was out in the open nationally. That was a surprise, because they were both nice ladies and both reasonable separately, but it demonstrated to me very forcibly how Hatfield and McCoy feuds began almost from something they couldn't remember, but at the end were killing each other over the growth of an animosity.
On the other hand, was there a stunt or an event on the program that turned out so much better than you had expected? Something that had extra benefits to it?
Oh, yes, that often happened. Everything happened on the show. In 19 years, there was nothing you can mention that didn't happen, because we had people who... As a result of some stunt, changed their whole lives. For instance, we did a thing where we took a sealed plastic case with a telephone number and an address inside of it, and we dropped 12 of these into the Pacific Ocean. And they said, the first person who phones us with a number and breaks this open and phones us will get, let's say, $10,000 reward.
Mm-hmm.
And months went by, and then one day we got a shortwave message from Kwajalein Atoll in the South Pacific, and a native boy had found this on a beach in an uninhabited, not an uninhabited, but a incommunicable type atoll. And they waited for a month to get favoring winds so they could bring it to the naval base in a twin-hulled canoe. And the guy broke it open. They were afraid it might be a Japanese bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew this young man all the way from this atoll in the South Pacific to Hollywood, did a stunt with him, showed him things to do, gave him money to go out and buy whatever a guy would buy with $50 in an hour, and to come back and report in stores that he never even dreamed existed. But anyhow, we gave him the $10,000, the final blow off, And he went back and changed the entire life of that island. For instance, they had never had water supplies that were dependable. And with that money, they built a reservoir to catch the rain that came at intervals. And they set up a medical center. Well, this $10,000 just changed the whole life of those people forever on that little island.
It's amazing what a radio show can do.
Really is.
What did you, where did the idea come from for the house party?
I was in San Francisco, flying up and back every week to do People Are Funny, because I still was doing my shows in San Francisco.
You're still doing those 20-some shows every
week?
Yeah,
I cut them down to about four or five, but I like to live in San Francisco. So I stayed up there, and I'd be doing a Man in the Street show for, you know, for a couple hundred dollars on Market Street one night. The next night I'd be in Hollywood emceeing a coast-to-coast radio show. It seemed a little incongruous, but I enjoyed both lives. So I started interviewing kids up in San Francisco as a part of a show called What's Doing, Ladies, for Safeway Stores. And John Goodell and I had an idea. Why don't we sell a show called Under 21? Five a week, daytime, where we take kids from 3 to 21 and vary all of the things that they do, from accomplishments to little malaprops. So we cut a record, and John took it back, and Young and Rubicam liked it and submitted it to General Electric. And they liked it, but they said, we want a five-a-week, half-hour show, but we only want kids for about 8 or 10 minutes. So we went to work, figured out a lot of other things to do, and used the kids as the only feature 5 days a week, and did things that I was doing in San Francisco, like looking in ladies' purses, naturally interviewing guest celebrities and authors and things like you're doing right now. And GE bought it, and that show stayed on the air for 25 years.
And that made a very easy transition to television.
Very easy, yeah. Much more so than the other.
Was it being simulcast at any time?
Yes, a lot of for 3 or 4 years, 5 years.
You must have had some pretty interesting experiences with the kids, because they really are unpredictable.
Yes, it led me into a whole new way of life, because by writing the book, Kids Say the Darndest Things, out of my experiences, which was a number one bestseller for 2 years in a row, unheard of in the nation, it really, people remember the kids more than they remember the rest of the show. And a lot of people say to me, you used to have that show where you interviewed kids. And I said, that was only 5 minutes out of 30. How about the other 25? You know, they were good minutes too. But the idea of interviewing children was so unusual and was so difficult. Very few people were able to do it. And it was so startling. And in those early days of radio, when censorship was quite intense, you know, we couldn't use words like pregnant. You couldn't say a woman was pregnant. And that was a no-no. It was terrible. Now they not only say it, but tell you how she got that way in detail, in front of an audience, and they'll applaud. But how times have changed. So at all events, the kids would say things that the network would let go by, because they were set in innocence by a child, that they would never let a writer write or a professional performer say. And so the kids were the first of the Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman type things. And so they, and you know, they'd say things like, I'd say to a child, what does your mother and dad do for fun? And he'd say, search me, they always lock the door. Well, a CBS censor would faint at letting that pass on the a show like the Jack Benny show or the Burns and Allen show, but they could get by, because what does a five-year-old kid know? They wouldn't let me repeat it as a story that was said, because I know what he said, but he could say it.
And you, indeed, sometimes baited them on a little bit.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, there's no doubt about it. And I got criticized by people who said you shouldn't encourage children. And I say, well, what do you want? The kid saying, my dad's a painter or a plumber, that's not very funny. But if he says, my dad likes to play poker every Monday night in the basement with the minister, then we got something.
Right.
But we never told him to say it, and we never cued them to say it. But I had a very smart teacher who picked them up at school each morning at 9 o'clock in a limousine, and the school picked the kids, you know. We had nothing to do with who the kids were, and we went right down to all the schools. We had a very difficult thing to get, and that was the approval of the Board of Education of Los Angeles for children to be taken out of school on a school day and taken to a commercial radio show. Now, you know, that takes a lot of approval.
And how, yeah.
And so we had to agree to go through all the schools. We had the black schools and the brown schools, and we had the ghetto schools at a time when they never got any nod of recognition from anybody. That was a long time ago, before this whole matter of civil rights and equal rights and ethnic rights was even dreamed of. And we went right down the line, and those schools got television sets and radio sets and record players for their use, which were very valuable. And we also got kids who were great. And the teacher would be with them for about 2.5 hours, tour the CBS and so forth. And while she was with them, what she was really doing was interviewing them. And they didn't know it. And she'd bring up subjects and talk about things. And if a kid said something that was very cute, she'd jot it down. Mm-hmm. Now, the chances of that kid saying the same thing to the same question was the shot I had. And quite often they never said the same thing twice because they weren't told to, and they may not have really believed it, or they may not have thought about it again. Mm-hmm. Or if they said something really funny that, I'll give you an example. If a 5-year or 6-year old child was riding along and the teacher said, well, let's play a little game. Who's the President of the United States? And one of them says, Abraham Lincoln is the President of the United States right now. That's pretty funny. So she'd jot it down, make a little note of it. She'd give me the note. In the meantime, in the bathroom, one of the other kids says, you're an idiot. Abraham Lincoln or George Washington isn't the president. And they'd say the real president is Lyndon Johnson or Kennedy or Truman or whoever really was. And so when I'd ask the kid the question, I'd get an answer that had been corrected. On the other hand, I got answers that were corrected wrong. They told them, Abraham Lincoln is not the President of the United States, it's George Washington. Because they didn't know either. Or one time, a little boy, I had a note that he had a dog. You know, he had a pet turtle named Ozzie Nelson. I thought that was kind of cute. So I said to the boy, do you have a pet? And he says, yeah. I said, well, what is it? He says, it's a dog. I said, what's its name? He says, Rover, or something other like that, doll. And I said, well, didn't you ever have any other kind of a pet? You know? And he said, we used to have a turtle, but my dad flushed that down the toilet. So you see, I got a better one. I also got disappointments where I had great answers from the children that I knew they'd said, and I never could get it back. Never could get it back.
But that's the way it worked, and
that's the way it worked, and so it was fun for me. Yeah. And I got a lot of things, of course, that the teacher never heard of because I had a way with children, and the secret of my success with children was really quite simple. Number one, I'm a good communicator anyway with anybody. Number two, the children who were on the program had all seen the program, so they knew what was expected, and that was I was going to talk to them. They weren't surprised, they weren't baffled, and they also knew that they could do what other kids were doing, and that is talk about things they knew about. They weren't going to be asked to juggle, sing, ride a unicycle, or do something that's beyond their ability. So they were ready for it. They'd been brainwashed, so to speak, at least indoctrinated, by just watching or listening to the show on the radio. And then finally, in the third place, a most important thing occurred before we went on the air. And that is, I went and talked to them for 5 minutes. And in that talking to them, I did something essential to the communication with children. I let the children see the child in me. In other words, I played games with the kids. I was not a big, distant, grown-up figure. They recognized in me somebody of the same mental intelligence and level. at least the same emotional quotient.
They were not afraid of you either.
They weren't afraid of me. They knew I was going to play games, mm-hmm. and they liked to play games. I played games with them in the dressing room. Mm-hmm. So when I got out in the air, we were just going on. Of course, the little ones didn't know what was going on. A four-year-old often would come up to me after the program was over and pull my sleeve and say, "Mr. Winkwetter." I'd say, "Yes." He says, "When does the show start?" I'd say, "What did you think that was out there?" "Oh, that was a show." "Oh, fine." But, of course, those are the kind, the little 3- and 4-year-olds who are just, you know, floating free. They're just marvelous. Like the little girl, I said to her, "What do you do?" And she says, "I help my mother in the house." And I said, "Well, you're only 3 and a half, 4. I said, "What can you do around the house?" She says, "I help her with the breakfast." I said, "Come on, what do you do?" She says, "Well, I put the bread in the toaster." She says, "Of course, I can't flush it." Or the little boy, I said to him, "Do you get an allowance?" He says, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, I guess you don't know what that is. It's money you get for being a good boy." "Oh, yeah." He says, "I guess I do." I said, "Well, what do you get?" He says, "I get a nickel. Every day I have a dry bed." And I said to him, "Well, how much money have you made this summer?" He says, "Nothing."
Kids say the darndest things, don't they?
They were a delight, just a delight. Our little boy had a Mickey Mouse wristwatch on. Somebody had given him for a birthday. I said, "Oh, you got a watch." He says, "Yes, sir." I said, "What time does it say?" He says, "It doesn't say anything. You got to look at it." Very direct. Older boy one time, I said to him, "What did your mother tell you when you came down here today?" And she said, "She just told me to be a normal boy." And I said, "Well, what is a normal boy?" He says, I think it's 98.6. These kids, you know, come up with some surprising bits of flashes of information.
You would often ask what somebody told them not to say.
Oh, yes, I had to do that protectively because the parents were getting nervous and they were brainwashing the children. Mm-hmm. See, we never told the children what to say, but it finally worked out that the parents did. They were telling them what not to say, and of course I double-crossed them very easily by asking them what they'd been told not to say, and it came out letter perfect, because they'd been rehearsed. You know, the little boy said, "My mother told me not to announce to the world she's pregnant." "Well," I said, "why not? That's a marvelous thing." He says, "She ain't yet." Or the little boy, I said, "What'd your mother tell you not to say today?" And he said, "Well, she told me I could say anything. But don't get this shirt dirty because it's brand new, it doesn't fit, and we're going to take it back when I get home."
Those are marvelous things. You made a kind of an interesting transition from radio and television into movies. You were in a couple of films, too, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I tried everything. I suppose when you're hot in this business and you can get any mm-hmm. door open, that you allow yourself to play with your own ego and your own vanity and imagine yourself to be some other thing than you are. You know, the clown wants to play Pagliacci, and mm-hmm. and the quiz master wants to be a movie hero or whatever. And I tried them. And I wasn't particularly successful, frankly. In the first place, I didn't like them. I don't like movies. And I wasn't very good at it. I'm very good at being Art Linkletter. Mm-hmm. I am not very good at being the Count of Monte Cristo.
You weren't the Count of Monte Cristo.
I certainly wasn't. But the things that I played. Uh-huh, uh-huh. I played a preacher. I played a wagon master and a wagon train. I did play a couple of MCs in pretty good-sized movies, one with Ronald Coleman and Vincent Price and Celeste Holm called Champagne for Caesar. And it still plays. I see it at 1 o'clock in the morning. Uh-huh. There's this young kid, kind of frightening. But I didn't like movies. They were mechanical. They were artificial. They are. They're shot out of context and out of sequence, and little bits and drips and drabs, mm-hmm. and they're super rehearsed, and you take one scene over 15 times, and the one you hate, the director picks. Mm-hmm. It's not your own business. It's somebody else's business. And it's like assembling a car, bolt by bolt. And the back wheel may go on first, and the top go on last or first. And, you know, it's a different technique, and I don't care for it.
I can see that it would be tough for you, because
no audience.
As a master of ceremonies on a couple of really great radio show and TV shows, you really were in control. You had everything depended upon you.
I was editing my own show. Mm-hmm. I was the director. I was everything because mm-hmm. I decided how long something should go within the context of mm-hmm. the overall half hour. Mm-hmm. And even more importantly, for me, there was an audience to bounce against. If I did something and I didn't feel the audience reaction, I changed right then and there and moved it around to what the audience told me by their reaction was the right thing. But how do you know what's right when you're playing a scene with some grip smoking a cigar 4 feet away from you looking on in a bored fashion? Mm-hmm. Not me. That's for Jimmy Stewart.
He does all right with it.
Yeah, it's a different kind of thing. You underplay.
Uh-huh. Since the house party and People Are Funny have gone off the air, what has Art Linkletter been doing?
I've been lecturing and making personal appearances and doing specials. Not only did I have my fill of the frothy, fun, game type of entertainment world for all those years, and had been successful in it and done everything you could do, but also the death of my daughter about 7 years ago... Mm-hmm. Changed my life and made me more serious and also made me want to do more meaningful things. So starting out with my drug abuse crusade, I got into many other kinds of lectures on salesmanship and on business and on the American family. And I do fundraisers for colleges, and I do chamber of commerce dinners and big convention meetings, about 90 personal appearances a year, and I write books. And I'm involved in probably 12 businesses.
Some of which are. What kind of businesses are you involved with?
Oh, building office complexes, publishing books, packaging toys and games, oil and gas business, sheep and cattle, real estate development, manufacturing. All kinds of things.
Very much out of the showbiz.
Oh, very much. Very much. I'm very much at home in business, mm-hmm. hard business. Mm-hmm. And I serve on the boards of directors of a number of major companies like MGM, Western Airlines, National Liberty, and so forth.
I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Delighted to do it.
I want to thank you for all the entertainment you provided for all of us over the years.
Yes, you look like about the age that could have been one of the kids on my show.
I could have, but my mother told me never to go on. Thanks very much, Art Linkletter.
All right, good.